You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Okay, well, I guess we can start now. Awesome. You're with this is The Brian Callen Hunter Mod Show. And we have, we got Dan Coyle, the author of The Talent Code, and David Epstein, author of The Sports Gene. Two books that I was just telling you guys off the air that I probably have quoted about 100 times in conversation. And every time I bring up what's in the books, people immediately reach for their phones and start writing down the author and the name of the book because they're both so fascinating to me. You know, it's the kind of information maybe as a guy I just love. And especially after reading The Talent Code, I've been watching lots of YouTube videos, and my tennis game has improved dramatically. And that's all I wanted to say. We'll see you guys later. No, that's... And you guys know each other? Do you guys know each other pretty well, or...?
Yeah, we know each other, definitely. Yeah. And I think Noah and I'll speak for Dan and respect each other.
It's true. No, we actually in a couple of different contexts. Even we were talking about stories unrelated to this. Well, maybe it is related. A little bit of doping stuff that we were connecting on, and Lance Armstrong stuff we connected on. Yeah. Both of us covered that story. But it's clear since we're kind of on this nature nurture thing. There's only one way this can end. Mm-hmm. You know, which is with some sort of competition. You know, whether it's Greco-Roman wrestling or arm wrestling.
That's what I'm talking about, guys. Let's get naked immediately. Not in a manly way, I mean, because what they did back in the day.
Yeah. Always comes down to Greco-Roman wrestling. Oh,
you guys will laugh, but I actually, my buddy was an international Greco guy, and he comes to my garage twice a week, and I actually practice, because I was a wrestler, but I didn't know anything about Greco-Roman wrestling, and I actually practiced Greco-Roman wrestling at 47 years old. So I would win that fight. How sad is that, by the way? Lance Armstrong is, I'm just going to say this, and I've read enough about it. I think he's a scumbag. I think that he's the kind of guy that lied and threw other people under the bus and didn't take responsibility. I actually think he's a sociopath. So to two journalists and guys who write great books, what do you think of that statement?
I think Dan is probably better positioned than any journalist ever has been to weigh in on that. So I'm gonna let him take a crack.
Because you wrote a book on it.
Yeah. It's good. Well, I wrote two actually, and there's I think there's a case to be made for what you're saying, Brian. I mean, there is, but the deeper case that fascinates me is that the culture part of it. I mean, there were a lot of good people that did a lot of really silly things in that culture, and he was kind of uniquely positioned to become kind of the most dominant guy no matter what sort of culture he was into. So part of it is him, part of it is no question. But what's fascinating to me is that the part of it that where you can look at that story and say, you know, I know a lot of people that would have responded kind of in the same way.
Well, there's a difference. Here's the thing. I don't know a pro athlete who doesn't do something who doesn't get a little hormonal help. I don't know how you how you play 162 games in baseball or how you fight in the octagon and keep your training levels to where they need to be when you're in your 30s, for example, without some kind of testosterone supplement or human growth. These guys stay injury free that way. So I don't want to say that when you take steroids as a pro athlete, I've never been a pro athlete. I don't know what that's about. But I know that if you told me I could make $20 million more and I could play the game I loved 5 years longer if I took, and by the way, look better and more muscular if I just took a little testosterone Cipiate or whatever it is, I would have a hard time saying no. My issue with Lance Armstrong or anybody is what his reaction when he got caught or when there was suspicion. It's one thing to do what you do to yourself. It's another thing to throw other people under the bus and try to destroy them legally and otherwise. Exactly. When they tell the truth about you because they have to under oath. That's where I draw the line, I guess.
Yeah, and you're right to draw the line there. That's where he's different than everybody else.
Sure.
Yeah.
But drugs are
other guys have recovered. You know, other guys have recovered from doping admissions in when it's just doping. The thing is, this isn't just doping.
Exactly.
Well, it's the same thing as Bill Clinton, right? I mean, the thing that everybody really objects to is not that he did what he did in the Oval Office. I mean, some people really do, but it's the fact that he wasn't honest about it.
Well, he was willing to drag that girl through the muck.
Exactly, yeah.
But whatever. But here's the thing. You know, Dan, you talk about how, I mean, I'm sorry, David, you talk about how you have to have a certain kind of hardware, and you do a great job of proving that in your book. Your body, if you come from the Biafra coast in Africa, chances are you're going to have a higher ratio of fast twitch muscle than if you were to come from, say, I don't know, Czechoslovakia or whatever it might be. Dan, you did a study of sort of the hotbeds of talent. Why, in, for example, in the school Bartok, I think it's called, in Moscow, a 77-year-old woman who teaches group classes with one court, she puts out world champion tennis players or people who are in the top 20 consistently. And so you do this case study of these quote-unquote talent whisperers. And what I loved, the reason we wanted to bring you guys together is because, you know, it's you do need a certain amount of hardware. You do need a certain genetic, I guess, metabolic, you know, machinery to get to the top of a certain sport, depending on what it is. But then you also need great training. And you guys both did, it seems, case studies on both phenomena. One being you have to have a certain physical kind of body for certain things. And then, of course, comes the training. World champions have a combination of both, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't argue with that at all. I think one of the, just to jump off of that point that you took, I think people will probably find, I shouldn't say this because maybe Dan will throw something at me through the phone, but that we have less sort of dispute than one might think. I mean, I think some of the, what I was looking at is you know, when we normally the way, so normally most of the sports commentators and writers who spend a ton of time on television or on the internet talking and writing about talent, frankly, have never spent one second actually researching it, whether from the biological perspective, the training perspective, and the way that Dan and I have. And so I think one of the things that I wanted to point out was, you know, when we sort of tell these retrospective narratives about how someone succeeded, we're pretty much always starting with a population of people or performers where the range has been restricted quite heavily to people who have a certain kind of hardware that you then, start putting the software on so that you can get the right machine. And, I think Dan did an amazing job of sort of showing the best ways to speed the download of what I call in my book, sports-specific software.
Hmm.
Yep. I like that software hardware analogy pretty well. I mean, it sort of works, but there's some problems with it too. And the thing, and I think you're right, David, to say that we don't have a ton. That we really get down to it, I think we're on the same page to a kind of surprising degree when you really look at the science, when you really look at what works in the real world. But the hardware software where it fails is in the case of that hardware implies that there's a ceiling, that there's an absolute limit. And with certain raw athletic skills, yes. There's an absolute limit. We live in a physical world. There's a limit to how fast I can run a marathon, an Irish-German kid, right? But when it comes to cognitive skills, when it comes to complex skills, I keep going back to, you know, like the case of a guy like Tom Brady. You know, his NFL combine film, he looked like a man running through cheesecake.
He really did, dude. He really did. His body, I am an actor, and I look more athletic than Tom Brady with my shirt off. I'm sorry.
Everybody looked at it as he was the least agile quarterback ever.
Yeah.
Everybody looked at that. His arm was not spectacular. His arm was average. And everybody looked at that, and 199 teams did the commonsensical thing. They like said, no, thank you. This guy's not going to be a star. He's not going to be a starter. He's not going to be an all-pro. And they were all wrong. And they could look at the hardware in great detail, but what they missed was the fact that the software can actually grow the hardware. Mm. The software makes everything better. And in some skills, like sprinting, jumping, what I'd call raw athletic skills, the hardware is by far the most important thing. But for most athletic skills that we are celebrating, watching in Sochi, we celebrate in football and tennis and golf, those are like cognitively built. They exist in the brain, and you can actually create them. And that's the interesting part that I think is worthy of kind of putting a magnifying glass on, because the brain is plastic and you're actually creating something that wasn't there before. And that, to me, that's fascinating because it takes away this idea that there's an absolute ceiling with complex skills.
I guess what I would say about Tom Brady is that the fact that he had a bad combine, I think, shows how poor the combine measures are, not that other skills don't matter. I mean, the combine is notorious. It's a joke. You know, you measure people for bench press, and you dock guys who have long arms, which is what you want on the field because it's a huge leverage disadvantage for bench press. So measuring a guy at his 40 for a quarterback shouldn't even be done. But Tom Brady, I think that, in my opinion, it's a bit of a fallacy that he didn't have a strong arm. I mean, he was drafted as a catcher into Major League Baseball and would have been a higher draft if
I didn't know that. I didn't know that about Tom Brady.
Yeah, if baseball, by the Expos, if baseball teams had thought he was going to play baseball instead of football, they probably would have drafted him a lot higher. So the idea that, so if he was poor at the combine and he was drafted late and then became a legend, I mean, is the suggestion then that he somehow, between being drafted and becoming a legend, caught up with different kinds of practice? I think it would be more that they just don't measure the right things at the combine.
No, look. I think when we look closely at his story, you'll find a guy who's got this combination of what I would think of as sort of soft skills, you know, characteristics, traits, ferocious practice habits in his wallet. You know, he carried a series of reminders from his high school coach, from this guy who coached him when he was 14 years old. These really basic drills, and he'd return to that guy a couple times each season to refresh himself on these really, really basic drills, like a great musician would, like a great surgeon might. So, you know, it's this combination of things. And when you look at the position of NFL quarterback, the ability to, as Peyton Manning has shown, like, you know, there's another guy who took, you know, three pages and pages of notes when he was visiting Tennessee, you know, who's filled notebooks over the years, but with intense study that improve his ability to read, react, predict what the defense is going to do. Right now, we see an old guy without much of an arm who's throwing ducks who just had, you know, the greatest season by NFL quarterbacks ever. Yeah. And to me, the beautiful thing about that season was that it was all software. His hardware has gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. And his software keeps him performing at the top level.
I think that's only if you sort of define software as these purely physiological things, and there's ample evidence. I mean, actually, so even though cognitively complex skills are more difficult to learn, so the baseline number of hours of practice that anyone needs to learn them, the individual differences in learning rate actually goes up as skills become more cognitively complex, not down.
So Say that again, David. Explain it again.
So the more complex a skill gets cognitively, the more hours it takes any human being to put in to learn it. Like, language is a good example, right? Like, nobody's born learning it, but we all have genes that other primates don't have that allow us to learn it. But the more complex the skill gets, the learning rate difference between people goes up. So if you look at pairs of identical twins studying cognitively complex skills, the difference in the learning rates within pairs compared to between pairs gets larger as the skill gets more complex, suggesting that talent, which manifests as a learning rate, is even more important than cognitively complex skills.
But there's a huge, huge problem with twin studies, which is that, you know, it's very difficult to sort out what degree of that is, you know, the culture of the family and what degree of that is. I mean, you know, by very fact that you look like your twin, people say the same things to you. That, you know, so if your twin is doing well in English class, they treat you very, very differently. They assume, oh, you must be good at English too.
That could be, but then that's why you look at it with fraternal twins that have a shared environment versus identical twins. But that said, it's certainly not perfect, but that doesn't mean, I mean, I think the onus is sort of to falsify claims that are made in science, right? So if the claim is that there's no biological input to learning rate of these skills, I would say where the science stands now is that's not correct.
There's no way. One of the things that baffles scouts, quarterback is a very good example of, you can have a guy who looks amazing in college and then just doesn't translate in the pros. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But being a quarterback might be a bad example for this anyway, in the sense that, you know, you do get better being able to read a defense in split seconds, being able to chunk that kind of information obviously comes from, Dan, what you call sort of this creating that myelin sheath. I mean, creating those neurons and being able to recognize the way a chess player can look at a board for 3 seconds and can tell if he's been there before. And it seems to me that the more you play quarterback, if you can stay injury-free, the better you become at that particular game. The rest is fundamentals, of course, how your release and your drawback and your footwork, and those guys are always working on that. So I can certainly see that, provided you do have some athletic ability and you've been given the time and the nurturing, and if you are a compulsive person like Brady and Manning clearly are, where you just, you know, I mean, can you imagine carrying that around and looking at that thing in your wallet or going back to your coach that you had at 14? That's going to make you a better quarterback. It's going to make you a better boxer. It's going to make you a better anything, certainly musician. So I don't think necessarily that is it may not be such a good example, really. But having said that, I wonder if there is something in the human eye, if there is something built into those guys, hardware speaking. I mean, if there's something in Tom Brady or Peyton Manning's, you know, the way their eyes are or whatever it might be that enables them to read a backfield so quickly. Or at least they had something in it that they were able to, as they did it more, somehow their brain or their eye was better suited for that than someone else. I don't know. I don't know if we can, you know, I don't know if we'll ever have a physical test that can suggest that this kid in college is going to be great in the pros. There's just too many factors. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, so one of the questions I would have about Brady is, well, I mean, the only thing really, right, that you'd want to see to predict if a guy's going to be a good pro is how good he is at quarterback, not running or bench pressing or anything like that.
Right.
And I guess I'd be curious, and I don't know what the answer is, to hear, you know, Dan's thought on why Brady was not as good in college as he was in pros. I mean, I think some of it has to do, and I don't know how much, with the fact that in the pros you get this sort of flat maximum where you're really restricting the range of how good your performers are because they're all so good. And then things like the rest of the team around them becomes really important. And I think, you know, guys like Brady and Manning have had sort of more stable situations and things like that, a better chance to kind of learn a particular offense. But I'd be curious to hear what Dan's thought is on why some of these guys seem, you know, why Brady, I guess, wasn't a better college quarterback.
Yeah, no, to me, the biggest difference is how much they leverage their learning opportunities.
Mm.
You know, and you see some guys that are high leverage guys. You know, I'm here in Cleveland, Ohio. There was a guy named Yan Gomes who was the 30th highest prospect in the Toronto Blue Jays organization last year. 30th. He came here and now he's one of the top three catchers statistically in baseball. And I've talked to the coaches there. I've been spending some time there with the Indians, and they raved about how he approached each drill, how he approached each opportunity, approached each day. He got more in the same way that a great student will get more out of a great teacher. More out of each second of learning than all the other players did. And I think of Brady, I think of Wes Welker, I think of guys who are obsessive about keeping notebooks, who are, you know, naturally very super competitive, but who sort of have a system where they can transfer information into performance at a higher rate than other people. And that system, and this maybe connects to comedy too. You've got comics that are just better at getting material. Than other guys and or film directors who are better at producing more stuff than other film directors. And I think there is really there's opportunities to learn all around us, and people that really are at the top levels of performance are able to capture more and use it more than other people. And that's what, to me, that's the greatest difference. You know, you can measure them all you want, but what you got to do is find a way to measure the efficiency of that learning process.
Well, you know, Dan, to jump on that for a second, it's interesting because Dov Davidoff is a great comic and said, I was talking about your book. And Dov said, well, look, at the end of the day, though, Brian, you know, as a comic, nobody taught you timing. You've always been funny. And I thought about that for a second. I thought, well, you know, at this age now, I've been doing stand-up so long that my ability to kind of get up in front of anybody and make them laugh is second nature, you know. And sometimes I forget, you know, you kind of go, wow, I don't remember writing this, but it's great. But what I realized was, I thought about it, was I was always funny and a class clown. But that started at a very early age out of necessity. I was moved around all the time, and I'd be thrown into a new situation, and the only way to get people to like me was to be a jackass. I liked people. So I would figure out a way to flatter somebody or be a jackass and make them laugh. And I learned at a very early age that if I danced or jumped around, it's like, hey guys, you know, whatever I did. And I got very good at reading people and figuring out what they wanted to hear and what they liked. And I think now when I get in front of an audience, you know, it's so second nature. I've been doing that from a very, very early age. And when it comes to comedy and timing, what I was saying to a young comic, would you have a time when you sit down and write? And I said, you know, man, comedy now for me is a mindset. I am always writing. I have trained my brain to always go into that space no matter what. And so I think so much of my, so when Dove says, well, nobody taught you timing. Well, no, in fact, I learned timing and I learned comedy. I don't think I necessarily had the hardware. I think I just had been doing it for 47 years, you know, and now I'm really good at that. So I think that, I wonder, I mean, I think with something like comedy and things like that, I certainly think it had to have been, you know, way more software than it was hardware.
And also, I mean, in terms of what you talk about in the talent code, Brian's practicing in the most difficult space possible. If you're moving from culture to culture to culture, then you're really having to figure out, you know, you can't rely on, oh, there are standard jokes that work in my culture. You're trying to find, you know, comedic universals. So it's a much, much harder practice space, which leads to him being the funniest man alive.
Let's have a hand for Brian Callen, guys. Seriously, let's have a hand. Dave, let's write a book about me. Yeah. But anyway.
I think that's a great point. And actually, you touched on something that's really interesting, whereas like athletes, you know, and comedians, you can always be asked or told how you did something, and you don't always know. You know, so a lot of things, I think, that might be in someone's nature, they explain as having been the result of practice, and vice versa. People will explain, well, I was always able to do this, but maybe not really, you know. Maybe they actually learned it. And I think it's I remember this really kind of fascinating when I was reading through twin studies and things. There was one of these identical twins who were separated at birth and didn't know about one another until they were in their 30s. And, you know, when they were interviewed by psychologists, they were both turned out to be like fastidiously clean, like just crazy about organizing things. And one of them said, well, my adoptive mother was, you know, such a slob, I never wanted to be like her, so I was really neat. And the other said, well, my adoptive mother was so neat that I emulated her and decided to be really neat.
Uh-huh.
And those could both be true.
Yeah.
Those could both be, there could be different environmental stimuli that lead to the same outcome, or it could be part of their nature that's acted upon a certain environment. You know, it's hard to say, but I do think it's important to, when you're told that something was in your nature, to think about whether that's really true. And when you're told that it was all the result of your work, to also think about whether that's its own kind of sort of revisionist history.
Hmm.
But one of the things that we've really learned is, what is the consequence of making that decision? Like, if you decide that it's in your nature to not be funny, well, then that's going to affect the way that you approach your practice. Or if you decide that it's in your nature, and that's all Carol Dweck's work at Stanford. But yeah, so I think that's the interesting thing. I mean, there's so much consensus, you know, that, yeah, obviously genetics in the realm of sports matters. But, you know, practice also makes a huge, huge difference. And we have a choice about how we think about ourselves in such a way that's going to serve us doing the best kind and the most practice possible.
No question about it. And my hope is that, you know, I guess it seemed always natural to me, the idea that practice makes a huge difference. So that was never like kind of a revelation for me, but the, you know, I guess what I hope would be taken from some of what we're learning about genes is that getting people to the place where they're most likely to succeed in the first place, and then having a growth mindset.
That's the major point there, David. That's what I loved about the book is, you know, look, you are probably, if your son is built a certain way, he should probably be on a tennis court or on a cross country track, not trying to play middle linebacker. That was never going to happen for me. You know, I'm 170 pounds with a strong jaw, albeit, but still, and broad shoulders and a tapered waist. But I still wasn't going to be in the NFL, guys.
A horse. You have a horse.
That's exactly right.
Polo.
So I don't care. I don't care, Dan, how many, I don't care who my coach is in football, Dan. I'm not playing in the NFL, no matter what, right?
That's right. That's right. It's a physical world. You know what I mean? It absolutely is. I mean, it is. I love that point you're making too. It's about the stories that we tell each other. We tell ourselves about ourselves, you know, and those stories are immensely powerful. And what's been interesting too is seeing the pendulum swing. I mean, David and I have been watching this, and maybe to some tiny degree affecting these pendulums going back and forth. But even watching the commercials for the Olympics that are on right now, it's like that 10,000-hour rule stuff has gone almost too far the other way. You know what I mean? Where there's people that are, you know, the Dan Plan guy playing golf for 10,000 hours trying to get on. People are using that 10,000-hour rule as some kind of gospel, as some kind of marching order, and it's actually filtered down to even the youth sports, where they're organizing their practice around this idea that once they get 10,000 hours, they'll be brilliant. Oh. And that's just flat wrong. I mean, it's kind of crazy to build your life around that sort of stuff. On the other hand, we're coming from an era where it was all about the genes for a long time. It was all about the natural gifts of people. So it's just amazing to see this story sort of unfold in our culture in front of our eyes and swing a little too far one way, swing a little too far the other way.
Yeah, and I would say I was just recently at the Australian Institute of Sport, and a soccer coach showed me his plan, his training plan that had built in exactly 10,000 hours to take players from age 8 to 18 in exactly 10,000 hours.
Wow.
You know, without having read the primary source paper. And I think, like, one thing that Dan has really done a great job of is helping to shift some of that narrative away from just this focus on sheer quantity and looking at quality of practice, right? Because, like, going to the driving range and swatting at balls is not the same thing.
Well, it's going to,
I mean,
sure,
engaged and working on your swing.
10,000 hours of the wrong practice is going to give you wrong technique. You see that on the tennis court all the time. You've got to be, it's that thing that Dan talks about called deep practice, where you better be practicing the right way under proper tutelage, or you're just going to ingrain those bad habits even deeper. Right? I mean, that's the idea.
Yep.
Well, so much of what the challenge is essentially, I mean, and this is really what you're hitting up, Dan, is that there are these sort of simple belief systems, right, that the public is struggling to get past. Like, before it was all genes or what make you a great athlete. Now it's magic number, 10,000 hours. Let's hit that, just like pass the time until we hit that magic mark. How do we get the public to, you know, and I mean, obviously we have this choice as individuals, and maybe that's how we shift the conversation, but to, you know, move beyond these sort of simplistic ideas and have a realistic model for how we make the most of our own potential?
Well, three things come to mind right away. One is, you remember the Blues Brothers, where they got the van, they put the sort of you know, loudspeaker on top of it.
Yep.
Do that with this podcast, and you just drop it.
That done.
Problem
brother.
Solved.
That's not a problem.
Yeah.
And then you have everybody buy David's book, and you have everybody buy my book.
Exactly. I think mandatory reading.
Mandatory reading. And no, to me, it does come down to sort of this question of narrative, and a lot of times. I think people just need to educate people. You need to tell them as close as you can to the truth of what's really going on. And the thing that gets overlooked all the time is this word of ownership. You know, all these great performers have got real ownership over their process, you know, and you've got a culture in which parents sort of sign kids up to do stuff and drive them around all these places and try to get them to specialize at age 8 and get on that program for 10,000 hours. And what gets lost in the shuffle is the love portion, the passion portion, and trying to, you know, create a situation where you can shape the path for people to pursue what they love in a way that actually makes them better, and in a way pursue things that they're suited for and that they love in a way that actually makes them better. And the more you learn about the space, and the more you copy best practices of who the best, you know, who's the best coach around, who's the best music teacher in your town, who's the best football coach in your town, and seeing what works on the ground, the sort of more accurately you can pursue that. But yeah, it does need to change. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety out there around this area. There's a lot of interesting research in this area, and having these kind of conversations, I think, are the first big step.
Well, you've also got to learn. You know, my buddy, who is an MMA fighter, was a pro football player before that, and I said, if you could have gone back to do something different in high school and college, would you have wrestled and would you have boxed? He said no, and I thought that was very interesting. I said, why? And he said, because football on that level taught me how to lose, how to compete, how to deal with failure, how to deal with incredible competition. And I take that with me into the octagon, and it works for me. And that's the advantage I have over other guys. So even though I wasn't wrestling and I was competing at a very high level at a different sport, and the mental edge I have over a lot of these guys is what I use. And I thought that was very interesting. So other disciplines, even though you're not specializing in one, other disciplines can be just as valuable because of the mindset that they require.
You know,
right?
That's a really good point. And actually, if I can just add one thing to what Dan was saying and that point, you know, about where to go from here. I just wrote an afterword for my paperback, and I saw Dan just wrote about this same topic about hyper-specialization in youth sports. And there's now just kind of a steady drumbeat of data showing that performers who go on to become elite actually are practicing less early on than performers who plateau at near elite, and that's in the sort of more physiology-based sports, and now it's showing up in team sports too. And sort of because of the way that the data are taken, we can't exactly tell why that is and what's going on, but I think it might be kind of a segue to having these more complicated conversations about nature and nurture, and about whether that early sort of sampling period where you test a range of skills early on instead of focusing in really early is the best way to go. I know Dan just did a little bit of writing about that, and I think that's really going to be an emerging topic where you might be able to sway some parents, because you can say, look, this isn't just an issue of the mental health of your kid. It's actually also a performance issue.
That's right.
So that might be a good sort of keyhole to sneak through to start having some of these conversations.
Well, Andre Agassi's book, Open, does a great job of that. He hated tennis. I mean, he hated it. His father made him, if you see what he had to go through, and he calls the ball machine, I think, the dragon, and he just had to keep hitting. And at, when he won Wimbledon, I think at 22, he had hit 2.2 million balls or something. He didn't like tennis. So yeah, I think you have to be very careful with a child's psyche. That shit becomes work after a while, man. Mm-hmm. We play sports because they're fun. You know, if you're having to, I can't imagine having been made to wrestle year round. It was so stressful as a kid, sucking weight and going up against some guy and you're half naked in front of a bunch of people. It was very valuable for me, but it certainly, by the time I got to college, when I would smell a mat, my back started to hurt. I didn't think it was just a reaction of all the weight I had to suck, you know? So you have to be very careful with how I would imagine, and I'm sure you guys are coming to this conclusion, you've got to be careful with children, man. It's got to be fun, right?
Yeah, no, it does. It was a great little sort of an informal study done by some folks who had tracked older athletes for a long time, and they asked them, what did you dread the most? These are successful athletes, people who played at the college level or above, and they asked them, in retrospect, looking back on your childhood, what moment did you hate the most, and what moment did you love the most? And the moment they hated the most was the ride home after the game with mom and dad. They
wow.
just that conversation where it's like, how'd it go? What did coach say? What did you guys do? That sort of interrogation that anybody who's a parent kind of knows. But then what they loved the most was when their parents said this one sentence, which was just this. It was just, I love to watch you play.
Wow.
That's what they liked the most.
Man.
And so easy to forget, like, the importance of this emotional engine that really drives it, drove your success in comedy. It drove David and my work in writing. This idea of wanting to kind of join this enchanted circle of performers that really it has to be this internal motivation. And to have some parent who's acting as a cop about the process, who's not just being kind of, you know, supportive and loving to watch us play or do what we want. I mean, that is such a powerful role for parents to play, and yet so often we sort of forget to play it.
I can't believe you said that. I watch my daughter ride, and she gets so annoyed when I ask her, did you ride Skittles today? Did you canter? Instead of saying, I love to watch you ride. That makes complete sense, man. It's such a simple sentence, but it's something that we forget. That's very, very interesting. And I have to say, guys, that your book, your work, Dan, your work, and David, your work, in no way cancels each other out. Both your books are just as relevant, regardless. I mean, that's what's so great about, you know, the work that you've both done. I it seems that neither one of you disagree with really what the premise is. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, Dan, when it comes to practice and correct practice, that's as relevant to anybody who has the hardware. In fact, you have to have it. I don't care how fast you are. If you don't have the right coach, and the guy who has the same genetics is going to be faster. So that's what's kind of great about and so relevant about both these books and so exciting. Is the guy that you did a case study of who did 10,000 hours of golf, how is he doing as a golfer?
Oh, I actually just talked to him the other day. He's what do you say his handicap was at, like 6, I think it was. So he's actually better than most golfers are now. But he's also, his rate of progression is slowing down quite a bit.
Yeah.
Which I guess you'd expect. So he's gotten really good, and probably, I don't want to like speak for what people believe, but probably gotten better faster than a lot of people thought he would have.
How old was he when he started this whole experiment?
Oh, gosh. I want to say he was like 27 or something.
So he's older, yeah.
Look, yeah, and so he's gotten quite good. And that said, he is really loving it. The people it's brought him into contact with. And so I think whether or not, you know, and sort of one of my points was not that he necessarily won't make it at 10,000 hours. It's just that there's this huge variation, right? Like maybe he would have been a guy who made it in 4,000, or maybe he won't make it at 40,000. But it's pretty clear to me that he considers this journey a complete victory.
But Dan, you talk about, I think it's in your book, about chess players. You don't have any grandmasters that didn't start playing that started playing after 12 years old. They all had to start building that myelin sheath earlier. Is that true?
Yep. Yep. With certain things, it seems to be true. Certainly with music, you don't have many people. But that said, very few people have got the sort of resources, gumption, and potential web audience to sort of do it in advance. So this guy is a guinea pig on that. And yeah. I know, like, Greg Norman started golf after a very, very varied athletic career. Same with this Korean, Y.A. Yang, who did quite well, won a major. So there is precedence for sort of late starters to do pretty well in sports. So, you know, just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it can't. But it's clear that, you know, it's far, far, far better and more efficient to start at a young age.
And one of those damaging narratives that we have is nature versus nurture, which makes us think that it's one or the other. But that's what's so great about your books complementing each other, is it's really nature plus nurture.
Yeah.
That's nice. That's a nice way to put it.
And I would say, and then other stuff too. You know, if people think of nurture as being just sort of practice, I mean, then there's other stuff, right? There's luck, there's timing. It's not just nature and nurture. Obviously, there are critical times. I mean, Dan just mentioned 12 years old. I think that's an interesting time because that is when you see even the lower level of grandmaster, like the chances of becoming an international master in chess, just plummet if you haven't been exposed before age 12. That's also the age at which you can't generally change your native language anymore. So there's obviously some sort of neuronal pruning going on that's pretty important around that age. And so I think it's nature, nurture, and then other stuff.
Well, the other stuff might be that what Dan said is with the practice at an early age might very well be changing, rebooting your hardware. I mean, if you create a thicker myelin sheath or whatever, that is part of your hardware, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And I mean, it's actually interesting that because, you know, language learning is something that I care a lot about. And, you know, people tend to talk about that sort of 12 years. You have to learn it before 12 years. But I actually sent Dan an article a few months ago about Mary Hobson, who began learning Russian at the age of 56 years old. You know, she was sick and her daughter brought her a copy of War and Peace. And she thought it was so sad that she would never read War and Peace in the original Russian. She's now 74 years old, has translated, you know, Pushkin apparently better than anybody else into English. She has her PhD in Russian. Wow. There are all these videos online of her delivering talks purely in Russian. And I mean, she started at 56. So much of it is that, again, like that's one of those narratives that really settles in. And the problem is that you're not allowed to do experiments in general on humans.
Or there are
parameters.
Yeah.
And so it's very easy for these ideas to develop, and it's often very hard to test them. I mean, the classic one in linguistics is that I think it was Leopold, the emperor of Belgium, decided that he wanted to find out whether language was innate. So he took two children and locked them in a room and wouldn't allow anyone to speak to them to see if they would develop language. Generally, we think that's not an okay thing to do to a child.
Yeah, I would agree. Leopold was an a-hole.
Yeah.
When that does happen in cases where kids get like locked away or found in the forest or whatever, if they haven't been exposed to language by age 12, they never learn it.
Yeah,
they never learn it.
I mean, the wolf children. That's what they call them. They call them wolf children, which is probably not politically correct.
I was raised by wolves.
They became comedians.
I was going to say, exactly. Exactly, man. Yeah, man. The other day I was thinking about this. I was on stage and I realized that what I was doing was when one side of the audience, like one chunk of the audience was a little tired or a little low energy, I would naturally kind of direct my next stuff to them. Or if the audience is laughing really hard for the first 20 minutes, what you realize is you go, wait a minute, I got to pull this back because they're going to be exhausted by minute 60. And you start playing the audience kind of like an accordion. That stuff I never would have even thought imaginable or possible 10 years ago. But as you continue to communicate with different audiences across a broad spectrum, you know, sort of a large area, whether it's Canada or, you know, the United States, you get really good at reading and chunking all that information. Mm. And you're kind of it no longer almost becomes about the comedy. It almost becomes you're kind of like breathing air in and out of the audience somehow.
That's the awesome part of this. I mean, in a way, because learning is a great word that Robert Bjork likes to use when he talks about learning. He's a guy who sort of coined the term desirable difficulty. He talks about learning as scaffolding, which is such a great term because it's not just sort of like another, you know, another gig in your hard drive or another megabyte or something. It's actual scaffolding. So the more you do, the more you can do, and it's connected to each other. So, you know, in your early days as a comic, you were sort of, you know, paying attention to a certain subset of stuff, focused on your material, focused inward, and now you've automated huge parts of that. You've built all this scaffolding, and now it allows you to build more.
That's exactly right. That's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
And that's really the relationship between automaticity and attention. You know, you put your attention on something, you put your attention on your ABCs, you automate them so you don't need to think about them, which then allows you to learn, put your attention on words and so on and so forth. And that scaffolding process, I mean, we really do understand that pretty well now in terms of the relationship between how that actually works in the brain.
Do you ever find that, you know, with athletes, I always think about this, because with athletes, by the time they've really mastered something, and they keep learning. Like, my friend's 37 and he keeps getting better as a fighter. The problem is his speed is slowing. He's not recovering as quickly. His back feels like old meat. And it's so frustrating to him, because he's like, look, I'm better than I ever have been technically, and I understand fighting and I can see openings and shots and I react so much better, but I'm just not the physical phenom I was when I was 25 or whatever. Do you talk to athletes who are just so frustrated that the machinery, the computer is better than ever, but the machinery just can't respond?
For sure. I would say, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, in some ways, I think because if people have learned better modes of practice, they can delay that more than they did in the past, partly just because they, you know, some of the myths of, like, of, you know, how quickly you have to age. I think it's pretty clear that to some degree aging is more of a choice than we thought it was in the past. Mm. You know, so that you can delay some of that with compensatory skills. And actually, Bill James has done some really neat work showing how hitters start to compensate by sort of changing their skills and getting better at, you know, anticipating where balls are going and being more discerning about their, you know, the pitches they're taking. So they tend to draw more walks and things like that. And so they start to compensate, which lets them hold on somewhat longer, although certainly not indefinitely.
Have either one of you guys done any research on nutrition and the best way to eat if you're an athlete?
Not me.
So I've done some things on that. I mean, I wouldn't qualify myself as an expert, but it's really interesting, right? Because now we're sort of, I think, low carb is like what a lot of people are hearing now, whereas if you spend time with the challenge and marathoners in Kenya, they're almost on an all-carb diet, basically. Mm. They eat something called ugali every day. But, you know, sugars and carbs are actually great fuel if you're going to go burn them right away.
Yep.
The problem is most people are not going to burn them, not only right away, but not anywhere in the near term.
Right.
So I think for athletes, actually, they probably get the same advice a lot of times that the general public does, but it's not necessarily appropriate because they want those efficient fuels that you're going to burn really quickly, whereas most people don't want those efficient fuels because they're not going to burn them.
What about, let's talk about steroids, guys. Dan and Dave, I mean, you guys, I'm sure you're exposed to so many different athletes. The fact of the matter is steroids, if used properly, work. They work in terms, they make you stronger, faster, you recover better, you usually probably stay injury-free if you're doing it the right way. Talk to me, how extensive is, obviously with the Tour de France, Dan, you've done a lot of writing. I mean, I've heard people say you probably couldn't do the Tour de France if you weren't on some kind of a cocktail. I mean, it's basically impossible.
The Onion had a great headline where it was like, you know, clean Tour de France rider finishes after, you know, 47 weeks or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's certainly, you know, it's possible to do it clean, but it's sort of more theory than reality, certainly in the last few decades. But the sport has gotten quite a bit cleaner. I mean, the stuff does work, and we're sort of in this strange frontier where sports are being judged by one set of rules, and yet in the military you see the use of this stuff to survive. Certainly in the general public you see use of this stuff. Is it low T? Ask your doctor. It's a friend of mine wrote a book. It was all about he went and tried some of this stuff himself because it was becoming so prevalent in the lower level of cycling that he was cycling in. No, it's a tough thing to navigate. But it's clear that, you know, sports is kind of struggling with one question of how to define sports, how to define what's legal, and the rest of us are also navigating this at the same time. I mean, it'd be great to get in a time machine and go ahead 50 years and say, so how did this whole thing sort out? You know, who got in the Hall of Fame? And what's the average testosterone use among a normal 48-year-old guy in the world now? Because it's going to come down to the stories that we tell. How are we going to frame these questions? Are you restoring a balance that you lost? I was having an interesting conversation the other day with a military guy. And people in his unit were all starting to take testosterone because they got so depleted in training that they wanted back to a normal level. And they saw that as completely legit. Now, if they were Tour de France cyclists, they'd get chucked out of the race. So we're navigating all this stuff. I'd be curious to hear what David has to say and where it's all going, because it seems right now that it's really case by case. And we haven't really settled on a kind of a moral framework to view all this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you mentioned what's it like for sort of the normal 48-year-old guy, and I think that's really going to be a big question because the as stupid as it sounds, I was just reading Endocrinology News the other day. In the decade from 2001 to 2011, the prescriptions for 40-something men in the U.S. for testosterone quadrupled. Right, so if this continues at that rate to become something that's so common, you know, then is it like athletes are the only people who aren't allowed to use it? At the same time, just in the last couple of weeks, some of the results coming in from some of the first long-term studies of testosterone use showing some health benefits and very increased rates of, you know, serious cardiac failure and things like that. So
wow.
I think we are sort of right there right now, you know, looking to see if the decision is going to be the health benefits sort of, you know, outweigh some of the negatives of this or not. And I think probably at this point, endocrinologists in general would say for young people who generally don't need it, any risk is too much risk. But boy, as it gets more prevalent in society at large, I think we're really going to have to have kind of a public discussion.
Well, the other problem is that, you know, if you talk about, say, let's say you take a guy and say, well, you can't take any testosterone, you're an athlete. But what happens when you get a fake, when you get a cadaver's tendon put into your knee where does that fall into the category? That's an artificial, I mean, that's somebody else's tendon you're putting in to your knee, and it allows you to play that much better. If you take beta blockers, what's that say? To keep your heart rate down or whatever if you're competing, et cetera, et cetera. It gets very sticky, doesn't it? It seems to me that the reason steroids are illegal is because they work really well, really quickly.
Yeah, and beta blockers are banned in some sports, actually, for that reason, because you can slow your heart rate down, you know, things like shooting and golf and things like that. But obviously you can get therapeutic use exemptions for them. But I think that's a great question, and I've thought about this a lot, and I cannot think of any non-arbitrary line to draw, basically.
Right, and where are we headed with technology, with nanotechnology, with nanobots that can, you know, these nanobots the size of red blood cells that can oxygenate your blood? You know, Ray Kurzweil in his book, The Singularity is Near, and if you listen to some of his speeches, he talks about the fact that we are getting close to the point where you're going to be able to shoot your body up with, say, 12 of these little nanobots that oxygenate your red blood cells to the point where you can hold your breath and sprint for an hour or hold your breath underwater for a long time. Good luck competing with a kid in high school who has those nanobots in his body if you're an Olympic athlete and you're doing it natural. You're not competing, man. Or how about myostatin, you know, the inhibitors and things like that? There's a chance you're going to have preternaturally fast 400-pound linemen in the NFL in about 10 or 15 years, if you read most of the, you know. So it really is a difficult, it's kind of a forest. We're on the frontier of something we probably don't know yet how to even put into context, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Somebody's going to have to develop the language, develop the story, develop the framework that we're going to use to navigate this. Because right now, it's just a free market, free for all.
Yeah, our biology that we are born with is becoming sort of somewhat out of date as technology, as we mesh with machines and these kinds of things. It really does, you know, I think we're going to look at our own biology as sort of, that's an old phone. You know, you're still using that flip phone, man, from the 90s? What a loser. I mean, we really are headed in that direction, I feel.
It harkens a little bit back to where we started, which was with the Lance Armstrong stuff, because that's his moral point, and it's kind of a challenging one. He's like, so, yes, I did it. Damn right I did it. I did everything I could, and that's where we're all headed, and deal with it. You know, you think the NFL wouldn't do all this stuff? You think the NBA doesn't do all this stuff?
Oh, sure.
He kind of dares you to deal with it. And in that way, I think that conversation is kind of old as it seems, is still very much alive.
Very much alive. I mean, the NBA, I mean, that's my friend was saying that the other day, who's a pro athlete. He said, you don't think the guys in the NBA are doing steroids? Take a look at how built they are and go back 15 years and take a look at what they looked like then and now.
Just George Gervin, you know?
Yeah.
Nope. Yeah, no. Nobody's going to accuse skinny Kevin Durant of doping, but it's clear some big changes. And those guys get tested four times a year, and once they've tested the fourth time, they can't be tested anymore. So
I didn't know
that. Once you get the fourth test, I believe this is the case, David, correct me if I'm wrong, but once the fourth test happens, the players' union has successfully argued that they can't be tested anymore. So if you've gotten your fourth test and it's playoff time, go for it.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. And I had a lot of colleagues at SI who would say, well, you know, it's a skill sport. Those drugs don't help. And I say, well, steroids are testosterone analogs, so any sport in which men are better than women, they help.
Absolutely.
And I once got my hands on a steroid ledger from a guy who got deported because he was a huge dealer, and there were a bunch of college basketball players in it.
Wow.
There's some really interesting, you know, aside from just the straight out kind of doping question, some really interesting applications of sports science now that probably just aren't high enough on the radar for anybody to worry about. But things like, it's pretty well shown now that if you put, you know, the oxygen masks that like football players suck on when between play, those actually do nothing between plays because there's plenty of oxygen in the air between plays. Mm-hmm. The problem is you're not fixing it quick enough. You know, your myoglobin and your muscles isn't taking it quick enough. But when you're actually going full tilt, if you're a really good athlete, you can get to the point where you're moving your blood so fast that not all of your hemoglobin is picking up oxygen. So when you're actually moving, if you can breathe increased oxygen, you can be an advantage. So there are runners now who are doing their workouts on a treadmill with a hyperoxic mask on, and it allows them to just train way harder than they would be able to normally.
Wow.
That is insane.
I love it, man. I love it. Oh, God, I got to get on steroids immediately. I want to be the most muscular podcaster in the world.
Yeah. It's okay. Maybe the kids already understand this because it's interesting to see the cultural move away from these sorts of like, oh, I'm going to be the fastest, or I'm going to be the most, you know, have the most endurance, to more of the tough mudder social races, mm-hmm. or to more skateboard stuff where there's not necessarily a quantitative way to measure success. You know, the sports culture is sort of changing, maybe in reaction to kind of the cyborg element here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a great point. Yeah. Huh. That's a great point.
Explain that. That's interesting. That makes a lot of sense. Sort of this, I don't want to be Frankenstein, kind of like the idea that I'm just going to stay all natural.
Right. Well, there was just a recent study that they talked about how there were fewer people running marathons per time, you know, there were more people joining, you know, this tough mudder and these other Spartan races, kind of these adventure, adventure races or something where, you know, you're swimming through these pools and you're getting shocked and you have to go over these walls and they're not time. They're not time. It's about being together and about having this crazy experience.
It's about finishing the race, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everybody's a winner. And you know, that's kind of where in some ways, maybe that's a response to, you know, kind of the Lance Armstrongification of certain types of sports.
Right. Is there any way to boost your testosterone naturally? I hear deadlift and saturated fats and all that.
Oh, there definitely are. Also, and I know a scientist who experiments with this, watching porn or violence, because obviously testosterone, as much as we call women hormonal, men are actually much more prone to hormone fluctuations.
And wow.
So, you know, primarily testosterone rises at opportunities to mate or to fight. Oh. And so there's actually a guy who was working for UK Athletics for the Olympics would show guys, actually it looks like violent film works a little bit better than porn.
Oh, darn. Darn.
They would show them that before.
Because I was going to watch a lot of UFC and porn, and if anybody has a problem with it.
And run on a treadmill with a hyperoxic mask.
Exactly.
Masturbating.
That turns me on. Yeah.
There's a guy named John Coates, who's fascinating, was a day trader in England and then became a scientist and basically can blindly predict how much money a trader made that day by his spike in testosterone. His argument is that because testosterone goes up, guys get less risk averse. They will always create a bubble unless you have more female traders because their testosterone goes up, 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 up. They become increasingly risky until they finally cause a crash.
Wow.
So if you Google him, he's done some really interesting work where he's literally like taking hormone samples from guys like while they're on the trading floor.
Wow, that is amazing. They say the same thing about prison. There's a theory that guys who get really big in prison, they're not eating good food or anything else, but the constant threat of violence around them actually keeps their testosterone levels very high. And so they're always kind of in combat mode, and that will make you stronger and you know, more aggressive and all that stuff. So, there it is. Gentlemen, I really, really, really appreciate you coming back on. This is, I could talk to you guys forever. And again, your books are worthy of not reading once, but twice, three times. It's just so much fun. And they've had a big impact on my life. So, and I know Hunter and I have talked about it a lot. So we really thank you guys for joining us.
It was a real treat.
Yeah.
Our pleasure. It's really fun.
Pleasure for me. Yeah.
Are you guys in New York in the next 2 weeks?
I am.
Dude, I'm doing the Gotham Comedy Club. Okay. Friday the
21st.
Friday the 21st. Saturday the 22nd. I got two shows Friday, two shows Saturday. and then one show on Sunday the 23rd. So I'm going to get in touch with you. You will have VIP treatment. You bring whoever you want. I think we're probably going to be sold out, but I will create a great seat for you if you want to come and laugh. I promise I'll make you laugh, and then I'll kiss your ass afterwards. Drinks and food on me. Coyle, where do you live?
I'm in Ohio. I'm in Cleveland, Ohio right now.
Well, I performed in Cleveland once. But God bless Cleveland. It's actually a really pretty city, actually. I mean, a lot of infrastructure, you know.
You know, the secret of happiness is low expectations.
There it is. There it is. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you for joining the Brian Callen Hunter Motz show. Much appreciated. I learned a lot, as usual, and I consider it a privilege to get to talk to guys like you. David, I'll see you in New York.
All right.
Bye, guys.
Thanks, Hunter. Take care.
Take care, guys.
And the books are The Sports Gene by David Epstein and The Talent Code by Dan Coyle. And if you don't read those books, you are remiss. Thank you, everyone. I hope you learned
everything.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.